if we look at the US, the European Union and China, so the three largest players in the world, what we see is that if one of the three economies imposes a subsidy on a certain product, the probability that the others will impose a subsidy on the same product is on average 74%.
Economists have been talking about the return of industrial policy since the tail end of the pandemic, and there's no question it's back. But to what degree?
If we think about industrial policies, the visible hand of governments is not very visible. We have a huge transparency problem. My name is Michele Ruta. I'm the Deputy Division Chief in the External Policy Divisions in SPR.
Michele Ruta is a trade expert at the fund and with some colleagues compiled a new data set that shows the extent to which these industrial policies are being used and what their impact might be. So we have talked about the return of industrial policy in the past year or two, but industrial policy, like so many other things in the economy, has changed pretty dramatically. I mean, this is not your grandmother's industrial policy. How would you compare the industrial policy that we're seeing emerge today to the industrial policy of the 1950s or 60s?
Bruce, thank you so much for having me here. I think you have a point. There are many elements of the industrial policies that we see today that are not your grandmother's industrial policy. But there are also elements of the industrial policies that we see today that are actually similar to what was happening in the 20th century. So let me start with the similarities. Industrial policies does not have a commonly agreed definitions, but I would say most people would think of industrial policies as targeted government interventions to promote domestic firms, industries, or activities to achieve some objectives.
Like promoting national champions in certain sectors.
Economic development, exactly. Now, the rationale, the economic rationale for industrial policies is that there can be market failures. So markets don't efficiently allocate resources, governments step in and try to fix this problem. Now, this, I think, has not changed. It was true in the 20th century's industrial policies, and it's true today. Another thing that is the same is that governments, exactly like market, can fail. So there are some concerns associated to the use of industrial policies, which is the fact that governments may not allocate these resources efficiently, but may be motivated by political economy considerations, so favoring certain groups over others, or the fact that governments may just respond to what other governments are doing. That's the problem of tit-for-tat policies that lead to
protectionism.
That escalates, exactly. And again, these things, I think, are concerns that were true in the 20th century and are true today as well. But then there are also significant differences that we should be aware of. The first one that comes to mind, and others have talked about this as well, is the fact that traditionally industrial policy was about competitiveness, as you said, promoting maybe some national champions. And now, increasingly, there are new motives for industrial policies. This can be climate change, so promoting the transition, can be impacting the structure of global supply chains. People often talk about the resilience of supply chains. Or it can be simply national security or geopolitical considerations that are part of industrial policy motives. So new industrial policies, or some people say modern industrial policies, can be different from traditional industrial policies in this respect. Another element is that if we think back and we focus just on the competitiveness rationale for industrial policies, what governments really tried to do was import substitution. So they were trying to impose high trade barriers, maybe high tariffs, to protect the domestic industry from foreign competition. Now, the countries that actually did that were not very successful. The countries that were more successful were the ones that opened up to global markets. And here, the East Asian economies often come to mind. Now, there is a debate whether industrial policies helped this process in the academic literature. Some believe that promotion of the export sectors through industrial policy was critical. Others believe that this was not critical and actually these economies grew notwithstanding those government intervention. Now, this debate is out there, but the important difference is that we definitely have moved from the idea that industrial policies are about protecting domestic industries from foreign competition to industrial policies that is more about promoting exporters.
Hmm. So would you say that the industrial policy now that's sort of related to environmental sustainability, you know, those sectors that are working on climate issues, would you say that that's a little less controversial than the industrial policy that we saw in the 20th century?
I think that I would not make necessarily a comparison between today and the 20th century, but I think there is a rationale for using industrial policies that is based on the fact that there can be market failures. And I think the transition related to climate change is a very important example of this. However, I'm also conscious of the fact that there are risks to the use of industrial policies. And so we should keep those in mind as well. Mm.
So you and your colleagues have compiled a lot of data. You've essentially produced this data set of industrial policy measures that governments have been undertaking. What prompted you to do that? I mean, why did you think it was needed?
Yeah, so if we go back to Adam Smith, he used to talk about the invisible hand of markets. And this was opposed to the visible hand of governments. Now, if we think about industrial policies, the visible hand of governments is not very visible. We have a huge transparency problem. This is in part, as I say, because industrial policies are targeted measures. There can be many, many of those. And so it's really difficult to monitor and probably also costly. And in part because differently from monetary policies, where governments have an interest to be very clear and transparent to guide markets, in the case of industrial policies, this incentive is not there as strongly. So as a result, you have very poor information on industrial policy, and there is no global database that tracks what governments are doing in this space. This is a concern for economic research. The debate that we were talking about earlier, whether industrial policies can or cannot be helpful for export success, it's a difficult debate because you don't have the global information on this. So studies typically focus on a specific sector or a specific country. And obviously, it's also a limitation for policymakers not knowing exactly what's going on and the effectiveness of the measures. So what we did at the fund was reach out to Global Trade Alert. Global Trade Alert is an institution based in Switzerland, associated at the University of St. Gallen. They've been tracking trade-related policies since the global financial crisis, so they have a long experience there. And we basically asked them if we could join forces to track industrial policies. We developed together a methodology, and they collected the data. So it's important to note that they are the experts on data collections, not us. So they are the ones that collected the data. And then we analyzed together in the paper that was published earlier in January. So what does this database contain that we think is useful? First, it has information for 75 economies that cover 94% of global GDP. So all the large players are in there. Half of the economies are advanced economies, and the other half are developing economies. The information covers starts first in January 2023. It's a monitoring exercise, so it's ongoing. It's updated on a monthly basis. It tells you when a new measure comes out, so the date of the measure. It tells you the motivation for the measure, as stated by the government at least. It tells you the sectors that are covered by the measure. When this is available, we also provide information on the size of the measure, say the size of a subsidy, and of the trade that is covered. Again, generally there is a link that the users can use that goes back to the source of the information. So I think it is very, very valuable. If you ask me, is this the last word on industrial policies globally? Certainly not. There are many things that we could improve. First of all, obviously, there are many countries that are not covered. Second, there are some policies that are not really covered by this exercise. There are many regulatory measures that governments can take, but that's difficult to monitor, so they're not there. But definitely it's an improvement relative to what was out there before.
And is this available to the general public?
Yeah, that's made available to the general public, generally with a lag. So on the Global Trade Alert website, they can find the information for the first year. For the updates, they are not made immediately available to everyone, but they will be made available at some point.
And so what have you found since you started this exercise? Does the data show you anything that is surprising?
Yeah, so the data are for the first year of monitoring, so it's 2023. I think there are some results that are not surprising, but it's actually good to have this information. So we have talked about the return of industrial policy for some time. This was mostly based on anecdotal evidence. You know, the US imposes the Inflation Reduction Act, the EU does the European Chips Act, China does the Made in China 2025. So we know that a lot is happening. Well, here we can see more precisely. We have recorded for 2023 2,500 measures globally. Of these 2,500 measures, 71% are trade restrictive in the sense that they have the potential impact to distort trade flows.
That is very significant. 71%.
It's a lot, yes. Yeah. Governments also tend to reduce barriers on trade. That happens, but it's unfortunately, at least for 2023, less frequent. Now, it's very interesting to me because, again, I didn't have an exact idea before we looked at the data, how governments motivate what they're doing. Now, this is stated motivation, so it may be true or not. We don't know. It's what they say they are doing, and obviously it doesn't say anything about the effects of these measures. But it's interesting that the traditional industrial policy is well alive. So over 30% of the measures are for competitiveness reasons. Second, the new industrial policies motives are also quite impressive. So 28% of the measures are motivated by climate change reasons, which I think is interesting and speaks to what we were talking about earlier, that these are more important concerns today. The other rationale that is quite frequent is 15% is supply chain resilience. And then I think I was a bit surprised by that. Governments intervene for national security or geopolitical reasons, but this is the least of the stated motives for using industrial policies.
So industrial policy, this reemergence of industrial policy, is this an advanced economy thing, or is it happening across the board, you know, in developing countries, emerging markets, for example?
So in the data for 2023, advanced economies come up as the main users of industrial policies. Now, here there is an important thing to keep in mind. What we are recording in this database is the introduction of new measures. So we don't know about the stock, the existing stock of industrial policy. The reason why I'm saying this is that we don't know if overall developing and emerging economies are larger users of industrial policies than advanced economies. All we know that in 2023, advanced economies imposed more measures relative to emerging and developing economies. Another interesting difference between the two groups is that advanced economies are more likely to use subsidies, while emerging and developing economies are more likely, again, in relative terms, to use trade measures, things like tariffs or export restrictions. Now, this speaks to the differential firepower that advanced economies and developing economies have. One other thing that I wanted to add is that the dichotomy between advanced and emerging economies is not necessarily the only interesting one. Another fact that really stands out from the data is that if we look at the US, the European Union, and China, so the three largest players in the world, their measures account for 48% of total measures. So what the large players are doing is very important.
Indeed. So is there any, you know, data in this that suggests that this industrial policy is actually exacerbating the fragmentation that we've seen in the past couple of years? Or do you think that it might be, you know, the other way around?
I think, Bruce, the way you're posing the question is the right one, in the sense that I think there is a relationship that goes in both ways between industrial policies and fragmentation. First, in a more fragmented world economy, you may expect to see more use of industrial policies. This can be for different reasons. You may care more where you source your goods. You may care more where you sell your goods. And so this justifies or motivates interventions for supply chain resilience or interventions motivated by national security or geopolitical reasons. I would also say that in a more fragmented world, it's more difficult to cooperate on important public goods like policies for climate change. Right. And this may lead to more unilateral measures. So in that sense, this is not necessarily a good thing. So we would tend to support the measures that are motivated by climate change rationale if they are properly targeted. But cooperation would definitely dominate there. In a more fragmented world, this is more difficult. Now, the second relationship, I think, is also very important and speaks to one of the main concerns that we have. And the second causal relationship is that industrial policies may have an impact on geoeconomic fragmentation. We see this in two main ways when we look at the data. The first is that when we simply correlate the number of measures that are imposed on a certain product with the measures in a certain country, with the measures that others have imposed on the same product, we see that there is a very high correlation. This suggests that there is tit for tat. So that a government feels it has to intervene, say, on semiconductors, because other governments are intervening in that sector as well. And then we do an exercise that is purely illustrative, but I think it's very interesting. So as I said earlier, EU, US, and China are the main users of industrial policies for 2023. Now, what we see is that if one of the three economies imposes a subsidy on a certain product, the probability that the others will impose a subsidy on the same product is on average 74%. So that again tells you that there is a lot of tit for tat in the use of industrial policies. And this is why I was saying there is a concern that industrial policies may exacerbate geoeconomic fragmentation.
Mm-hmm. So do the old traditional mechanisms like trade rules that have long been established, are they standing up to this new type of industrial policy, do you think?
I think there are reasons to be concerned, and I think, in fact, people have been concerned on this. First of all, as you said, there is a body of rules that exist in the agreements that are overseen by the World Trade Organization. Now, the World Trade Organization has a dispute settlement mechanism that has exactly the goal, when there is a disagreement between countries on a certain measure, this can be adjudicated. Now, the appellate body, which is somehow the Supreme Court of the WTO, has not been able to function in the past few years. Right. And this has limited the effectiveness of the WTO in resolving trade disputes greatly. Now, as the use of industrial policies likely will continue to go up in the coming years, then this lack of a body that can properly adjudicate these agreements is a big problem.
Yeah.
And hopefully this will be solved soon. Now, the second concern is with the rules themselves. These rules were defined at an earlier time. And so some of the new practices that are coming up are not really covered or sufficiently covered by existing rules. The main example would be export restrictions. The WTO rules are really more about tariffs and import protection and reducing those distortions. There is a lot more flexibility on the export side, and this is a concern because export restrictions as a tool of industrial policy are going up. The second example is subsidies. Again, there is a subsidy agreement at the WTO, but again, there is a huge increase in the use of subsidies, and many consider that new rules would need to be agreed. But let's face it, there needs to be a strong spirit of cooperation to have a new set of rules on industrial policy.
And so what is the fund's role in all this? Does the fund perhaps have a role in trying to make sure that there are mechanisms and rules that are appropriate to this new industrial policy?
So we have started thinking about this at the fund, exactly because industrial policy is coming back, and it's important that fund staff has clear guidance on what to do on these topics. And there is a how-to note that will come out pretty soon that talks exactly about that. Hmm. Now, let me tell you what are the main ingredients, at least in my view. The first point is that the fund has a role on industrial policies whenever these measures are macro-critical or can lead to significant spillover effects. And in that case, it's clear that that somehow falls into the mandate of the fund. The second point is what the fund can do. Mm-hmm. And I think there are three things that we should keep in mind. The first is in the context of multilateral surveillance. The fund can produce data and jointly with other institutions as well. And the paper we've been talking about and the database we've been talking about is an example of this. Mm-hmm. And the fund can produce analysis. For instance, something we're working on right now is on the spillover effects of industrial policies, especially subsidies. I think this data and this analysis is very important to raise awareness and provide information both to professional economists and the public and obviously to the policymakers themselves. And the second aspect is the bilateral surveillance. Here again, this is when a policy is, an industrial policy is macro-critical or has the potential of having spillover effects. But the fund has a mandate to give policy advice in the context of Article 4 consultations. Now, in some cases, obviously, we do not necessarily have the right expertise, and we will need to work with other international organizations and institutions that have the expertise. But again, it's something that we'll need to keep in mind. Mm. The third point is that the fund, again, together with other international organizations, can exploit its convening power. And this is something that we stated in the staff discussion note 1 year ago on geoeconomic fragmentation. We had it again in the paper that went to the board on the trade review. And I think it's a very important point. The convening the main players, making sure that they see the facts, the data, the analysis that we and others are doing, and trying to promote a dialogue so that there can be a common understanding of what the issues are, I think it's an important role of the fund.
And the fund has been working on that for many, many years, developing relationships with these countries, so that can play an important role in trying to sort out the mechanisms for this new industrial policy.
Yeah, as you said, there are very good examples The debt roundtable that is ongoing now is a very good example of this. This is just applying the same logic to a new area that has the potential to be quite controversial.
Mikhail Ruta, trade expert for the IMF, thank you so much. Always a pleasure.
Thanks so much, Bruce.
Mikhail Ruta is a co-author of the new Industrial Policy Observatory dataset, which you can find at imf.org. And look for more IMF podcasts wherever you get your podcasts. You can also follow us on X, which used to be Twitter, at IMF_podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards. Thanks for listening.